Again, kids, it's Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the first flow has come again. I'm T.C. Downey. You're listening to the U's. With me on the air is Lehi. Lehi, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. How are you, T.C.?
I'm doing excellent, actually. A little mellow for this time of the day, but that's all right. At least I've had a little bit of coffee in me, and I had some wonderful muffins first thing this morning, and so I'm full and caffeinated and somewhat researched, so I won't sound like a complete blabbering moron this particular episode.
Right on.
What's going on with you, dude?
Well, personally, I just put up a new website. I haven't put my content up, but I'll probably have a new post after the show, probably. But entropicmomentum.com is my new website, if anyone wants to check that out and follow it. Expect content on at least 3 times a week, maybe, or at least once a week. Who knows? We'll see what happens.
Right on. Real quick, well, I wanted to make mention, we got Daryl hanging here on the line also. Daryl, what's going on, man?
Just hanging out, man, making trouble.
Right on. Well, I wanted to actually kind of thank you. I went back and took a listen on last week's show, and I realized that what prompted or what actually led into the next part of this discussion was initiated actually by you. You were making, you were trying to make some kind of, comprehensive comparison to the difficulty of wrapping your head around the idea that everything is both material and an illusion at the same time. And it just so happens that that's the exact direction that this show was going to take anyway, going into the fourth chapter of the book. So, I guess, like I said, thanks is in order.
Right.
So, this will be, I think, the last episode that we discuss the power of yoga. There's only so much you can talk about, and the material gets rather dense from here on out, and it's very I would say practically or practical in its essence rather than philosophical. So it's better that people read it and try this stuff out for themselves after that.
Yep, that's true. It's an individual thing anyway, so people should pick it up themselves. You can find the book at Mendez. So if you're interested in learning how to do this stuff, I would suggest going there.
Right. And with that, there's a myriad of things that we didn't really get into just in the first 3 chapters that are kind of also underlined throughout it. So it's definitely worth picking up and reading. Again, the idea was to hone the focus back in and kind of show some of the traditional heterodox that has it's manifested over the ages. So
that being said, where do you see this going after this show? Where do you see it going in the next show?
I think the next show we're going to start to take a look at early revitalization of Western magic. More specifically, I kind of want to look at the Blavatsky and also Levi and we'll kind of go from there. You know, we'll talk about some of the concepts that have occurred or came about, and then from there we'll work our way into what is now the current model of the left-hand path. So I think that should be interesting. It's not going to be done in one show, obviously. It's going to take a couple of shows to actually get there.
Of course.
But the last time we talked, we said we were going to be referencing Jason King's Ex Nihilo video, this show, because it definitely sets the platform for what is discussed in the fourth chapter, which is the human condition. Is there anything off the top of your head, Lehi, in that video that immediately kind of starts out this argument?
He starts off talking about why is there something rather than nothing is basically how it all starts. And he gives three explanations about why there's everything rather than nothing. The first being, or the explanation is, that there was always something, which you could kind of look to more of a scientific approach. When you look at thermodynamics, you see that energy has always been there. And we know that energy and matter are interchangeable. So according to physics, our visible universe has always existed to our knowledge. And the second viewpoint is that God, not necessarily an anthropomorphic God, not like gray-bearded Yahweh in the sky, but the philosopher's God, basically the primary principle, created the something out of nothing. And the third explanation is that this God, or whatever, you know, this first primary principle, created the universe from his own essence, which is more of a pantheistic approach.
Right. Now, we had talked that we were going to be getting into the differences between monism and pantheism here in this particular show. And I wanted to say, first of all, that there's no huge leap to make when moving from a monism worldview to a pantheism worldview. I think the best example throughout history of this kind of thing emerging in ideology would be to point directly at the ancient Egyptian way of thinking. All of those gods, all of those god personifications were just characteristics or manifestations of the same particular principle that we're talking about. I think that it's important to draw the connection there and realize that what you're doing is describing the same essence, the same thing with different characteristics added to it. It's like me being grumpy first thing in the morning. I'm not just TC, I'm grumpy TC. And so if it's something that occurs enough, you might recognize that as being an individual state and just call me grumpy. And I think that's the same kind of mental buildup that happens when making the connection between monism and pantheism.
Yeah, that's just a different view of the same thing. Another thing that kind of stuck out, which kind of helped us push into this idea a little bit more, was there was the quote that nothing begets nothing.
Right, nothing begets nothing. Yeah, so there has to be something. That's what that quote really goes for. And why I think that is a good point to bring up, Lehi, is that King offered a fourth alternative and then destroyed it immediately by just saying that he thought it was hogwash, and that was a metaphysical model presented by Hawkins. He didn't really get into the why, but what he said immediately after that kind of wraps this whole thing up, and he said that he was going to go ahead and break the Gordian knot and say that the three possibilities that he had given were all the exact same thing, that what he was talking about was three things from three different vantages. content, which were all the same thing. So,
yep.
Again, we'll go back to the pantheistic idea of, discussing grumpy and happy and sad, when those are still all just conditions of the same essence.
Such as those three explanations are just different ways of looking at the totality.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a few things that kind of strike out in my head immediately, and that is anytime a story starts with in the beginning, there's always an end implied. And that's kind of this false dichotomy that we've built up in our head, or one of the tatvas, I think is how it's pronounced, which we'll actually get into this chapter. So, with this being said, one of the things that I was kind of talking about when I started into the king idea, somebody had made a suggestion that zero was nothing. And from there, and King kind of talks about this, we have a build-up pattern where there are different layers of definition that kind of occur. If you think about a painting, you have this blank canvas, and let's just restrict our worldview to that blank canvas. But in that self, we've already made one division, because we've now divided the canvas from everything else that's around it. That canvas is still blank, and even though there may be paints, which now you have a second division, those paints haven't made it onto the canvas to begin to form a picture yet. So every time a layer is painted onto this canvas, you're creating another division. Every time you add another considerable or variable to the image, you're creating yet another division. So when King in that video discusses, looking specifically at zero to infinity on the positive side, he is implying that there is a zero to infinity on the negative side as well. But beyond that, and this is something Evola actually talks about in this chapter here, what we find then is there is also, beyond this horizontal division that we see in our mind, there's also this simultaneous vertical division that's happening. But I think we'll actually kind of get to the actual chapter itself here and hope that it kind of starts to build out the ideas that we're talking about here.
Right. I just wanted to throw out there, right before we do that, that things are only considered when compared to other things in differentiation. That something in and of itself means nothing when by itself.
Right, but when you get to a point of contrast, when you get to this is this and this is not, that's when something comes into consideration. And that's actually covered here in this chapter as well.
Yep, and it gets to the, they start with the duality of, or the presumed duality of Shiva and Shakti.
Right, and I guess it needs to be mentioned that, and we're getting ahead of what actually needs to be covered, but what needs to be mentioned about that first duality is that he says that it's not strictly separate, it's not truly misconnected, that they are in fact two perceptions of the same thing. So we'll point right back to the ex nihilo that Jason King was talking about.
Yep.
All right. So the first thing that kind of pops up here in this chapter is the fact that he wants to get into the doctrine of tatvas, or tatvas. I guess that's how it's pronounced. Yeah, I mean, if we're butchering it, oh well, look it up. And he says it's borrowed for the most part from Sankhya and Vedanta systems. God damn, I'm butchering the shit out of stuff today. it has various meanings, but in its present context, it means principle or element, is what he says. And now what I find interesting about that is that these principles or elements, they take a certain characteristic, and we'll kind of come into that a little bit here. I'm just bouncing back and forth to see if I can follow a stream of thought without actually having to sit and quote some of this text. I did, by the way, actually cut a little excerpt, which hopefully I'll share later, because I think it's very crucial when you think about how the left-hand path is manifested. But that's like 2 or 3 pages from where I'm actually at the moment. So,
all right.
But these tapas, they are they're doctrines of elements. They play a key role in actually developing consciousness. Way that he goes about kind of saying this is that on one hand you have an ontological principle that exists within nature, and then on the other hand there are these states or forms of experience. Now you hear people talk about this a lot, at least in the buzz of the forums at this point, about the difference between essence and form, and that is, in fact, what we're kind of describing right now. The ontological part, the principles of nature, that is the form. That is the form that's taken. But the experience itself is the essence that's being referred to. And so I think that we begin to see a hard development of what we've been discussing, well, since we got into this book, which is the idea that Shiva is all things and Shakti is its activity.
Right. And his experience of himself.
Right. And his experience of himself, exactly. So now we understand that Shakti is, in fact, the experience of not just self, but of all things, and that's where the core of this begins. Let me see here. He goes through and talks a bit about temporal limitations. He talks about people trying to describe things in some kind of a timeline, and why he feels that that's it's just not accurate. And what he does is he goes here and he makes a sort of a comparison. And that comparison is kind of vague in its own nature. But what I'm going to do is try to offer up some kind of an analogy. That analogy is that goes like this. The lifespan of a fly, as far as I understand it, is one day. It is born and dies in that same day. It comes into being and goes out of being in that same day.
Yep.
Now, we can move a little further along the, the hierarchy or imposed hierarchy of animals and complex organisms and get to the cat, which the average lifespan of a cat, it ranges somewhere between 12 and 20 years, depending on its breed and the conditions of its life. So now we see that time has taken different faces. I mean, the fly goes through like a dozen stages from beginning to end. And that all happens within a very narrow, time, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And a cat goes through those same kinds of stages, but it happens on a much broader span. Now, if we move again further forward to the human, the human's average lifespan, depending on what sex you are, it goes between 60 and 90 years at this point. So, again, we move through all of these different phases, but in a longer term, relatively. So we see now that as we move through the different scales of reality, that time itself becomes kind of a joke and that it's only... it's only relative to the experience.
Yep, and I remember he was saying that that time is just one tapa anyway, and that the temporal existence doesn't even apply to the rest of reality, that it's just one slice of the pie.
Right. I mean, and that's something that's very hard to wrap your head around when you think about the fact that here on Earth, if a man could live as long as material has existed, that's given that material had some kind of beginning in the first place. You would have one very, very, very old man where on the universal level, it might still be a newborn baby.
Right. Yeah, I think he was kind of tying that into samsara, whereas, you know, we perceive time as this thing that begins and stops, but really, it's just everything's changing. Everything goes through these cycles forever.
Right, and that leads us back to the three things proposed in Jason King's video, the three answers that he says are all the same. There was always something. Something came from nothing. Something was... what's the last one? I'm trying to think of how to simplify it. Let's see. Always something. Something came from nothing.
Through
and
God.
Then... what's that?
Through God.
Your God? Is that what
no,
you
I said?
Said?
I said through God.
Through God, yeah. No, I mean, where this wraps back to that is relatively simple in that, and I'm trying to think of what the hell I was saying now. I just stumped myself. I hate when I do that.
Oops.
The idea that there can be a time when there was nothing, to me, that seems absolutely impossible. And it's something that Jason King also touches on. That, you know, to think to yourself that there was a point where there was nothing. Well, I mean, from an artist's perspective, you know, you learn about colors, that black is the absence of all colors. And white is the totality of all colors. And when you think about that, the only difference between black and white then is the definitions that we've chosen to give it.
Right, the differentiation is the only obviously that's tautology, but it's our distinctions that make things what they are. And it kind of goes into the idea of avidya that we see these differentiations because we have this ignorance to the totality. We're focused.
Right. Well, I think the whole thing of it is, again, that there always was something. Material is eternal. There's an argument made for that in the chapter of this book. Material is eternal. It's always existed in one form or the other. It's just as that form has taken definition, as it has reached its tattva, it begins to arise in our mind, and we then can recognize it.
Because it has meaning, yes.
Yes, because it has meaning. So it's irrelevant to us outside of where it has meaning. And I think this is what firmly keeps me on the atheistic side of the proposed theism, atheism, dichotomy. The fact that there isn't some magic spell that just made the beam pop out from thin air. That leads me to believe it's either a form of emanation or pantheism, or it is in fact just a constant that is only recognizable and enjoyed through the embracement of its defects or flaws.
Yeah, we go back to the whole idea of perfection. Remember, Female Satan was talking about that in one of her blogs, about how perfection isn't desired. There's no forward motion with perfection.
Right, right. It's kind of stale. If there's nothing to do with it, if there's nothing that'll be changing about it, or nothing that tweaks that interest, then you land squarely in just a state of constant.
Yeah, you can't have Shiva without Shakti.
Let me ask you guys. Can I ask both of you a question?
Sure.
Sure.
When you're describing meaning, now meaning has its own meaning to me, but in the context that you guys are describing it, is meaning something assigned or something recognized?
It's both.
Well, I mean, I guess the underlying question would be, who is to say what is perfect or what is a flaw? You know what I mean?
Well, that's a good question, and it's kind of a paradoxical thing. It again points back to the fact that there's only the observer, and so meaning ultimately, from the singular perspective, is only what you assign to it or discover about it. I don't think there's an actual distinction between those two. Someone can tell you, that a tree is hard, but you're not really going to know that tree's hard until you've walked up and punched it or pushed up against it. Or you understand what I'm saying?
Right, but I mean that's definite. That's something I would say is physical or factual. A lot of what people call meaning is up to the individual and not necessarily shown. I personally only respect that which is absolutely shared, if that makes any sense.
That which is absolutely shared, is that what you're saying?
Right, which is, like we both recognize it as a truth, if you will.
What I find a flaw in that thinking, Daryl, is that at one point, everybody thought the world was flat. And that was a shared truth. But when we look at it now, today, we know that is as far from truth as calling you a black man, Daryl.
Right, right. And I get that. But my argument to that would be that the earth being flat was an assumption. They assumed that was the truth, but they couldn't have known it because it was never a fact. So
all things that are known are built off of some supposition or some belief. We exist within the universe, so there's no way for us to ever really know every side of it. It's like a box. Can you describe what the outside of the box looks like from the inside?
Well, no, and I get that. I do understand that.
The thing of it is that it creates a kind of a philosophical loophole. Now, where I think you get it right is that there are truths, there are material things, but the thing of it is that we don't exist in just a pure material thing. We exist between those two poles, rather, that we assume certain things because there are these material things. And so we need that to construct our world. And that's actually something that's kind of covered further into this chapter when we start talking about these tattvas. You see what I'm saying? There's it's a paradox, but that paradox exists. Because that's what we exist in. It's the paradox. We exist in between those two states. It's not like we are constant one way or constant the other. We fluctuate between the two on an infinite scale. The ground below you is hard. which means that the air above it must be soft. It's
you even have the two things
down.
To compare. Things are relative to each other. You got to have that distinction, that relativity.
I mean, that's actually, you know, once again, a great question because it kind of goes right into what we're talking about here in this chapter. Let me see if I can actually get to, it might actually be the quote that I was saving earlier. Okay, what he says is, we must now consider the tattvas unfolding until they reach the level of absolute duality. We will also explore the ascending phase leading to a perfectly developed human condition. Ordinary states of consciousness will be discussed in the following chapters of this book, dealing with practice. Practice is not concerned with metaphysical interpretation of reality, but rather with the tasks and realizations that one can come to by going countercurrent and by transforming oneself. So the very fact that you can question certain assumables, that in itself leads to the idea that you can question everything, always. That there never is a hard, solid line. It's just more hard or more solid.
Right. What is there a primary premise that we can take at the beginning, at the top of everything, that is irrefutable? Or is everything, at the end of the day, a circular argument?
I think at the end of the day, it's a circular argument. I really do. I think that things exist because they exist. To look for at the meaning of life doesn't start at, you know, how did we come to be? It starts at, what can we do? Does that make sense?
Sort of. I mean, I personally, I still think we assign a lot of that to it unnecessarily.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point of the quote that I read you in that, becoming countercurrent. Questioning things.
Instead of accepting it all.
Second.
Instead of accepting that the world is flat, we go on and find out whether that's true or not. And test it out.
Right, right, and you know, and that's what I call the interrogation. But like, it, looking at life and saying, what is the meaning of life? You know, life doesn't need a meaning; it just is. You know, regardless of what you want to think or feel about it.
Well, it doesn't need a meaning, but it does have one. I mean, that is the undeniable truth, that life has meaning. Life. Well, I mean, otherwise you would just sit still and not do anything. But there are things that you want to do. There are, you know, you want air, you want food, you want to pee, you want to fuck, you want to, you know, do drugs, whatever it is. You know, those are things that you not only need to do, but you want to do them. You know, life has meaning. It has, it's meaningful to you. It's not absent of that.
I think one of the tattvas kind of describes that there's this passion or attraction.
That's possible. You know which one it is by chance?
Let me check. There's a specific tattva for this.
Well, I mean, while he's looking for that, I'll just add that, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying or its presentation. I kind of invert it. And rather than saying because we are alive, we desire these things or we want certain things, I kind of look at being desirous as an aspect of life. You know what I mean? Rather than, you know, that's part of my being. You can't necessarily take credit for it as it's an aspect of what you are.
Right, right, absolutely. It is inherent that we have meaning. I mean, what you're saying is not wrong in any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the vice versa, the flip-flop, the paradox of this is the important thing to understand. It's not really which direction you're approaching it from, because we approach all things from different directions, all of us. It is the fact that you're approaching it. I mean, when you put it down in the core most, I don't know, simplest breakdown, the word meaning itself, meaning has particular attributes to it. When something has meaning, it has reason, purpose. It has an inherent psychological value to it. But it also has a physical value to it. It has an emotional value to it. And so even when you look at it on that scale, just the fact that us drawing air is on purpose. We're here for. We actually contribute to the environment by breathing in. I mean, as much damage as we do to it with some of the other stuff, our existence is necessary in the ecosphere as well. I mean, not specifically humans, but creatures that breathe air. It's part of what makes this magic happen. You know, like the plant, they suck in all the carbon monoxide and put out oxygen. We do the inverse. So we're kind of participating in the cycle of life.
Well, all right.
Lehigh. So,
you go
ahead.
Well, Daryl was about to say something.
Oh, that's cool, man. Go ahead.
All right, I found the tattva. Well, it's a part of tattva. It's raga, literally passion or attachment. It says, once the fullness proper to have short the night consciousness is actually attracted toward different objects.
Breaking up
okay,
for you guys?
Yeah, he broke up for me. Lehigh, if you want to just slow down as you're saying it and repeat it.
Okay, it was part of one of the tattvas, or a kind of kuka, or whatever, called raga, literally passion or attachment, as it's defined here in the book. Basically, it's this drive for things in the finite world to be attracted to other different things.
Right. What was the correlation that we were drawing to it? I'm sorry.
I kind of forgot, but I kept looking for it.
That's right. I mean, I know me and Daryl went one way, but I mean, it's all completely relative, and it's all actually what's being covered in this chapter. So even if we're not really referencing the material as much as some might like, it's there, and you can take a look.
Does a paradox have to be linear?
No. Paradox is the fact that they're a paradox suggests that they're opposite on all sides.
Right.
It's kind of why I think we have the manifestation of more elliptical shaping. If you look at things in the material world as we're observing them, they all kind of center around this dot, this circular dot. And it's like anything three-dimensional in appearance has a rounded shape to it. Even the edges of a square, it's not a hard move when you look really close at a square. It's not a hard move in a perpendicular direction. But a curvature of sorts. It's a harsh curvature, but it's there. So, anyway. I'm trying to think here, because it comes up, and what pretty much is saying throughout all of this stuff is that that there's three manifestations or three worlds. One is a world without form. The other is a world of pure form. And then there's the material world, which the material world is obviously the most defined. So it's a scale between indefinition or indefinite and definite. So, you know, he talks, then he brings this to the idea that there's three states of consciousness, then there's sleep, there's the dream state, and there's the waking state. And that waking state is described in realizing the most definition, which I think is completely in line with what you were saying a little while ago, Daryl, about you yourself valuing the shared truth, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, it speaks directly to that. That is, in fact, Shakti. Shakti is activity in its height. It's which it means it's not just your experience, but it is your experience intertwined with every other experience. So that's the hard material. I mean, that this whole thing from here kind of gets to be really philosophically dense. I'm surprised we moved to it as quick as we did. The conversation just kind of led us that way. Let's see.
Yeah, and I didn't get much further than that in the book myself.
Yeah, well, I've actually gotten further than it by a few times or whatever, but this last time around, going through it, I was starting at this point to question what exactly we're going to get into. I mean, I knew we would talk about the states of dualism before this even came up, which, again, I guess I wanted to wrap back around to the idea of monism and pantheism, and I said there are different states of ism or eism that happens between those, like dualism, and so forth. And dualism in itself is, if not an absolute, it's a perceived absolute. It's what the human condition is being described as. It's that constant recognition of countercurrents. You know it's hot because it's not cold.
It's a little bit of essence of as above, so below. We're like a microcosm of this higher cosmology, or this, or these ideas of monism.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The thing of it is, though, that it doesn't necessarily really exist on those harsh dichotomies. Like, we know for a fact that, 100,000 degrees is hot. Negative 100,000 degrees would be really cold, right?
Yep.
But between those, there's, 99,999 degrees, which is still hot, but it's not as hot as 100,000 degrees, and vice versa. So you see, now we come to the pantheistic perspective of it. What it really means, at least to me psychologically, is that if there is one, there has to be a division of it. That things must, in fact, divide. I myself, a couple of my papers, turn that to be the law of ramification.
So, are you speaking of equal opposites?
The thing of it is that there doesn't have to just exist equal opposites. There can be unequal opposites too. You know what I'm saying? If you draw a linear line and you divide it into 20 parts, 10 of which you label negative, 10 of which you label positive, negative 8 is still at the opposite end of the spectrum than positive 3. And, like, you know, you can play that with just about any number. There's still a dichotomy being presented, but that dichotomy is being measured on a different curvature.
Right. The only issue I see with that would be the issue of, I believe entropy is the right word, but, like, any time you have only so much of something, there's only so much area. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know if that's absolutely true. When you give something definition, then yes, but if you're looking at things from a whole world view, that's, I mean, you tell me where space and time stops.
I don't presume to do that.
Because it doesn't, or at least you don't know if it does or not, right?
Well, that reminds me of, I forget which of you said it before, but you were talking about a point in time in which there was nothing, you know, several minutes ago. But my observation to that would be that, you know, a point in time is something. So there could be no point at which there was nothing because that point is substance.
Sure. One of the things I've said in the past that I think is kind of novel and points right to this is when you say the word nothing, you're talking about no thing, which still implies that there's a thing.
Right. That concept is a thing. Right.
Right. So, I mean, and this is these concepts, these principles, these are what the tapas are. Different schools had different numbers. One had 25, the other one had 36. But these were concepts or principles that they felt were ineffable.
Kind of like laws of the physical laws of nature or the physical constants. And how they relate to each other.
That's precisely it.
Although it's kind of interesting, though, they actually, with the tattvas, though, those physical laws of nature are actually contained in one tattva, but still the same principle is with the other principles. There are these universal constants that are different.
Right. Well, again, he starts off describing the entire chapter by talking about the space-time temporal and describing its level of relativity. The same thing can be applied with these principles.
Oh, yeah, I thought of an analogy to explain the tattvas a little bit better. You can think of it as like a spectrum of light. Let's say light has a wide spectrum, a sliver of which we can see, but it's all part of light. It's all the part of the same thing, just looked at from a different way.
Yeah, and you can talk about the spark.
It doesn't require like temporal existence. It's you don't have to have one that comes after the other temporally. It's more of a what's the word? A logical succession.
Yeah, that's actually, I believe, how he describes it in the very beginning of the chapter. It's funny because we can talk about these things on different levels, but we can't, like, take some kind of scalpel and separate them. So when we're talking about them on different levels, we always kind of have to be mindful of how it affects the other levels, at least in its discussion.
Right, well, I mean, a thing that's important to me is, can you demonstrate it?
Yeah, you can absolutely demonstrate it. Just given the light spectrum analogy, if you were to move a little more to a tangible thing and talk about the spark plugs on a car, you can talk specifically about those spark plugs without ever even discussing the left rear tire. But it's all still a part of the same car. Now, what that spark plug has to do with the car, with the tire, the explanation can be vast depending on how mechanically inclined you are.
Right, right.
So, it's it. We've got about 9 minutes left here, and There was one other little bit that I wanted to kind of get to. I don't know. And that was what was made mention of before about the first two tattvas being Shiva and Shakti, which he describes as being two distinct principles, but two principles that are inseparable. So we give this symbolism of sexual union then, and that you take these two distinct, at least in our minds, polemic descriptors, and when you consider them being together or working together, they're manifesting or creating something. So and that's kind of the whole wrap here with the Shiva Shakti thing, is that they're inseparable, and not only are they inseparable, but they're constantly working together to create or to build forward. And that demonstrates the idea of emanation, flowing from one, moving from monism to pantheism.
Yep, because even kind of when it looks like, because even when it looks like they're separate, they are still part of the same system. You can't have one without the other, as it says.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. Because part of me is arrogant enough to want to say that this is the argument that should be used against atheism. The idea that that there is no sea or no thing, no divinity. On the other hand, you know, I realize that's easily defeated by a few different concepts, but still, ultimately, when you just pan out enough, the picture is so blurry, you don't really know what the intricate details of it are.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to also note that the common atheist, when they're, you know, arguing against the existence of a god or a deity, they're refuting a very specific variety of concept being presented. So they may not be well enough informed to realize that they might not be claiming that what we're addressing is non-existent, but I think they're addressing that, you know, like Christian and Muslim beliefs are non-existent.
Like Yahweh, specifically.
Right.
Well, here's what I wonder. If you call a tennis shoe a sneaker, and everybody else calls it a tennis shoe, then does that mean that the sneaker does not exist?
You know, I've been having this conversation everywhere lately. I guess I would say you could perceive it differently or utilize it differently, but it's not necessarily important to me what someone else chooses to call it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because everybody assigns their own meaning to it, their own definition.
But I've noticed that when you go against the grain, even in the crowd that, you know, claims to go against the grain, when you go against their grain, they become very upset. So there's something strange taking place there.
I don't really call it strange. It's inherently part of the human condition. They've assigned a value to it. They've kind of committed to their own dogma. I mean, whether that dogma is self-developed or whether that dogma is predefined and spoon-fed to you is somewhat a mute and irrelevant argument, which is why I sometimes laugh at some of the posts that are put up there, because they tear down a dogma by offering their own.
Right. And I'm not, I don't ever claim to be immune to that, but at least I like to think that I'm striving to avoid that.
Yeah, right, keep rocking the boat. That's what I say.
As long as you are conscious about what dogma you're following, as long as the principles that you rule your life by are yours and yours alone, made up by your own mind, I don't see how you're not... I don't see how you're not absolutely valid.
Well, the argument offered is what you said earlier. They're saying you're just making your own new dogma. But I'm like you. If you defined it by your own terms, is it actually a dogma?
Right. Well, you can't. That's the thing. I don't think that you can separate dogma from humans. It's inherent. It's actually what makes us human. There's the fact that we view things on that polar spectrum. That's kind of the whole point of this entire show, from the ex nihilo thing all the way to discussing the spark plug and the tire. Ultimately, you cannot exist without a definition. It has to be defined for you.
And going against the grain is the best way to do that, to create more definition,
right,
to keep going forward, to have samsara and the tattvas unfold. You have to go against the grain and break those models and rock the boat a little bit, even if people get butt hurt.
Definitely. Definitely.
So, I mean, to me, the most beautiful thing about the human mind is that it can change. And that in itself is kind of cool, because what that says about meaning and definition, that just can't be described in meaning or definition.
As if to say it's the essence of it.
Right. It is the essence of it. That's right. So we got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to say that everybody who listens to this archive or is listening live should, tonight at midnight, check out entropicmomentum.com, because Lehi's going to have some content up. And, I'll tease him a whole bunch.
Oh, yes.
I've actually checked it out, man, and even though it doesn't have any content, I like the way you set the page up, and I enjoy the little virus doodads at the top.
Yeah, I enjoyed making that. I took your advice, and I went looking for that subscribe button thing that you guys will have on your WordPress.
Right.
What I discovered is that particular widget, the follow blog widget, only exists by itself like that. It only exists within, if you sign up for a .wordpress.com website, because basically the software is attached to their software. So when I start my own website on my own server with WordPress software, it doesn't come with that, so I had to download a plugin that functions the same way.
So you do have something similar, though.
Yeah, so it should work. It's
cool,
just not exactly the same.
Oh, I mean, that's cool, man. Regardless of how different it appears, the functionality was my thing, because I forget about blogs that I don't get like a notice on, but I love to get the email like, oh cool, they so and so posted something new. So I definitely enjoy getting those emails.
It's like getting a little present.
Time's up. Next week we'll start into early Western magic, the revitalization. And hopefully get some forward progress going. So,
all right.
All right, yeah.